Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, good night to those of you who are going to sign off when I sign in. I'd like to welcome you if you're new to Cocaine Anonymous and tell you this is the fellowship that I crave. I got here November the 8th, 1988, more dead than alive. And but for the grace of God and his mercy, I've been able to stay here. And it's just been his power and his power only that I get power filled through this power. Well, I can say, no, thank you. I'm not drinking or using today. I want to thank Jay for putting me on this slate with some of the most powerful men and women that I've heard in Cocaine Anonymous. And I've heard many stories. But I'm going to tell you what my friend Johnny H. always says. The greatest story you ever hear is the one you tell yourself about yourself. And I had to fully understand what it truly means to be an alcoholic and an addict when I got here. I also want to thank Russ. Russ, thank you so much for keeping me straight, getting me straight and keeping me straight on the time zones. Cause I'm a seventh grade dropout. And I'm gonna tell you, I got this program cause I wanted to learn varieties they talk about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't get struck sober. I didn't have a white lightning experience like Bill Wilson in his story. I had to be shown, I had to be taught, and I had to learn what it truly means to be an alcoholic and addict. And thank God for those who are here that I stand on the shoulders today that they aided me and helped me when I got here. More, like I say, more dead than alive. I got here by way of a broke leg, a broke car, and I finally got broke. And I got here with an inflated ego and a whole lot of false pride that almost didn't allow me to stay. And I too didn't believe in God, didn't want a God, didn't need a God. Because what money couldn't buy, I didn't want. And in fact, I said F God when I first got here in the rooms of recovery. But they talk about me in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm sold on the ideals contained in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, you guys. And I'm going to talk about God, and I'm going to talk about the steps. And if God offends you and you run up out of these rooms, I'm a true believer that I'm on the B team. I'll be here when you get here. I'll be here when you leave. And I'll be here when you get back. Because the drugs and the alcohol will drive you back up in here if you're blessed enough to make it back. So don't be afraid of God, because God's not afraid of you. But I'm the guy who said F God. The book says that I'm the one that came to scoff but remained to pray. And I had to find out that, you know, I truly believe that, you know, that I'm an addict and I'm an alcoholic. And that I'm powerless over drugs and alcohol. And that I can never safely use drugs or alcohol in any form. And I'm a guy who sold dope, who made a lot of money selling dope at one time. And then I became my only customer. And I was my best customer and then I became my only customer. But, you know, I had enough money to burn a jackass standing 4 feet in water. But I had to believe that you can't buy this program. You know, this is a program that there's some requirements I have to meet in order to stay here clean and sober. But all this happened after I got sober. Let me tell you, I'm supposed to share what it used to be like, what happened and what it's like today. And I'm always doing that wrong. You know, I speak in a lot of places. I'm Gary speaking St. Louis in October. I do a lot of H&I. I love hospitals and institutions. I love talking to the new men and women in the Fellowship of Cocaine Anonymous. And I love after they get sober and they come to a meeting and I see them at a convention or I see them at a picnic or a marathon, and they say, man, you know, I remember when you used to come to the panels and used to share that sometimes you feel like a nut and sometimes you don't. And I shared that for 12 years in the rooms of Cocaine Anonymous. And I didn't share it because it was cute. I shared it because it was truly, truly, truly the truth. That for 12 years in this program, sometimes I feel like a nut and sometimes I didn't. And I hopefully I'll be able to get into that. But my disease started a long time ago. And it started in St. Joseph, Missouri, which is in the Midwest of the United States near Kansas City, Missouri. And my first love was alcohol. I love alcohol and I love the effects produced by alcohol. Then I got introduced to some cough syrup called Robitussin and terpene dehydrated codeine. And oh my God, oh my God. I love alcohol. I love drugs. And if I could use them today, I would use them. But the reason I'm here after 32 years is the same reason why I drink and I use. Because this program, you people, and the God of my understanding, give me that sense of ease and comfort.
It fulfills the promises, like the 9-step promises. Alcohol used to fulfill some of those promises for me. But what happened was I stopped controlling and enjoying my using. And I used to be a cucumber, but now I'm a pickle. I can't safely use drugs and alcohol in any form. That means I can't even sell it. I cannot barter with it. And I had to learn that. You know, on my way home today, I went down Figueroa here in Los Angeles, South Central Los Angeles. And the nickname is not for Figueroa, it's Figueroa. And there's prostitutes all along both sides of the street for about 5 miles. And on my way home, I had to perform, and there's a bunch of liquor stores, and there's a bunch of dope houses. So on my way home, I had to perform a triple bypass. I had to bypass the prostitutes, the liquor stores, and the drug houses in order to get here. I've been here long enough to find out what happens to people who don't perform the triple bypass, because they told me that the same man would drink and use again. The gentleman that's talking to you this evening is not the man who drug himself up into detox on November 8th, 1988. But listen, I'm in St. Joe, Missouri. What I'm truly addicted to is excitement, drama, and bullshit. And at the age of 10, going into almost 11, I stabbed a boy and nearly killed him because I used to love to fight. And I'm a good liar. And I had a mother who was my greatest enabler. And the school wanted to send, they did send a psychiatrist with his ink blocks to interview me. And I went home and I told my mother, she said, why are you getting home so late? I said, they punished me and kept me after school. And they had me talking to this white lady who I know she's a psychiatrist or something, mama. And they was asking me about grandma. And they was asking me about you and daddy. And I don't know why they're punishing me. Because the judge let me go. So I'm manipulating my mother. My mother goes to school and she tells him, you don't keep my boy. You don't punish my boy. There's nothing wrong with him. Even though I had a behavioral problem. You know, long before I picked up drugs and alcohol. I was. And if you're in the room, you probably can identify with just not always on the beam. Always felt either superior or inferior. Never felt just right until I got some substance in my body. Anyway, I was in a lot of crime, you guys. I was homeless at the age of 15 and had a home that I didn't go to because my father had too many rules. My father told me I wasn't going to have an afro. He told me I wasn't going to be a member of the Black Panther Party. I wasn't going to have Mao Zedong's Little Red Book in his house. He told me I had to be home at every night at 6 o'clock to eat dinner. He told me on weekends I had to be home at 10 o'clock. And everybody else stayed out till 12, 1 o'clock partying. I had to be home. So my father, he used to whip my ass. I mean, when I say whip ass, he whipped ass. And I got tired of getting ass whipping, and I got tired of being underneath his roof. So I hit the streets at the age of 15, and I had a ride. And I ran with a bunch of older guys, and I did a whole lot of crime. And the last crime was an armed robbery. I got caught, supposed to testify against my crime partner, didn't testify against him. He got killed. After they went to Omaha, Nebraska, extradited him back to St. Joseph, Missouri. I was supposed to go to court that afternoon, didn't go to court. He gets in a fight with the guy who did go to court. It's a long story, but I'm making it short. The police in St. Joseph, Missouri shot and killed him. I got rearrested, was thrown in a cell. Now, by now, I'm living in an abandoned house, which used to have lights, gas, and running water because my uncle left it to me. But by now, it's November, it's getting cold, no lights, no running water, no gas, and I'm sitting up in a jail cell. I've been drinking, Robitussin, terbinafine, hydrated codeine, and alcohol. And they came to me and they told me they're gonna warehouse me till I'm 18. They're gonna release me and kill me within a matter of 3 days. I'm gonna speed the story up. A well-known pimp who knew my grandfather, my grandmother, and my parents came and got me and rescued me and brought me to California. And I brought me with me. And I came right out here in California and I had a ride. My brother was down in Long Beach. He was selling heroin. He was selling pills. He was selling weed. He had a crew. He was a member of the BSU, Black Students Union, down in the Cal State Long Beach. My cousins were out here. They were twins. They were a member of the Panther Party. There's a lot of solidarity in Los Angeles in 1970. To speed it up, I got involved with selling weed, made a lot of money at one time. Then I got involved with cocaine in the mid-70s. The Ominous Warnings, I Failed to Heed. Richard Pryor, a well-known comedian here in the United States. I think everybody knows him worldwide. He burned himself up by pouring a rum and ether all over his body and setting himself on fire. There was a lot of prominent businessmen and doctors and lawyers who were losing their businesses. Nightclub owners were burning their businesses down for insurance money as a result of ether-based cocaine. And I got involved with ether-based cocaine. I was selling weed. Cocaine was $2,600 an ounce in the mid-70s. I was buying cocaine, selling weed, selling pills, made a lot of money, lived in Inglewood, California. By 1980, my wife almost gets killed by 12-gauge shotguns. I shut down the operation, left my wife. I can't tell the whole story, but I left my wife. And from 1980 to 1985, I stopped using cocaine, but I became a workaholic. I became a sexaholic. I became a gallonholic. I became a rageaholic. I became a newcomer in Cocaine Anonymous. Because I don't know anything about it. I have a disease of a twofold nature connected by a spiritual malady. I don't know anything about the phenomenon of craving. I don't know anything about my ideals, my emotions, and my attitude have to change in order to recover. I don't know any of this stuff, you guys. I'm just not drinking. I mean, I'm drinking, but I'm not using cocaine. And I go back to work. Like I said, I became a workaholic. And the big book talks about there'll come a time I won't have no effective mental defense against that first one. And that's what happened for me. From 1980 to 1985, like I stated, I was working, gambling. They weren't gambling fast enough. I opened up my own gambling shack in Long Beach, California. And I used to say shit like, I'd rather gamble and lose than not gamble at all. And it was really, really crazy. You know, I was fixing myself, you know. And so what happened was for 5 years, 80 to 85, not a cloud on the horizon. I got two bank accounts. I got a couple of motorcycles. I got a vintage car. I got a brand new truck. I got 150 men working for me. I'm working for a brand scaffold company. I'm a superintendent for a scaffold company here. I'm working in the refineries. I'm making a lot of money. I got a lot of girlfriends. I had women from San Francisco to San Diego. I got clothes. I got diamonds. I got jewelry. I got everything you would want in those 5 years. And I'm going to Compton because I bought a house when I was 19 because I can't tell my whole story. I'll be 70 years old and I'm 32 years sober. So it's a lot of stuff. I'm going to talk. See, like the longer I talk, the faster I talk, the louder I talk. Hopefully, I'm not losing anybody. So anyway, I bought a house when I was 19 years old. The girl was, I was 17. She was 27 when we hooked up. I bought the house at 19. She had three children. Now, these kids are Atlantic Drive Crips out in Compton, California, on the east side of Compton where my house is. And she's afraid that the house is going to be taken because of selling dope out of the house. She calls me. I arrive on a Sunday afternoon, stand in front of my house, being an evangelist, talking about the black genocide being perpetrated in America. Don't you see all these women out here on the boulevard selling the bodies for this cocaine? I ain't seen cocaine in 5 years. Last time I seen cocaine, you put a gram of cocaine in a shaker bottle, put some baking soda in it, you shake it, you cook it up, you bring it back, you get a rock about the size of a little bitty finger. That's the last time I seen cocaine. It was $2,600 an ounce. A girl come off the boulevard with a miniskirt, high heels, hair blowing in the wind, went and bought a $20 rock for my stepson. And before she got to the end of the block, all that good talking, all that good preaching about the genocide, about the unborn babies with the addiction and all this, the thought that overrides all of those, all good thoughts, said, man, call her back, give her money back, and give me $300. What I get for $300 that was in my pocket. Well, what it got me was jails, institutions, and death. From 1985 to 1988, that's what happened to me. I went to jail. I got stabbed. I got robbed. I got beat up. I did 45 days in jail for possession. I became unemployed and unemployed. And that's my story. I was living in garages. I was living in abandoned houses. I had a woman who was in the program. I like to call her not so normal Norma, who got sober in 1986.
And they say, you can't hear till you can hear. You can't see till you're able to see. And Norma was my great enabler, just like my mother. Norma got sober in 86. I got sober in 88. Norma would bring the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. She bought a copy of it. She laid it on the nightstand. And the book says, when he comes off one of those well-known stages of a spree. And I love that statement, the well-known stages of a spree. So that means if it's well-known, I am no longer in denial. But what I am is I'm defiant. You know, and that's after being around here for a while. So anyway, what happened was on November the 8th, 1988, but before November 8th, 1988, my stepsons had put out a bounty on me where I couldn't come on my own street in front of my own house because I was robbing people and I was selling them bunk dope, you know, rocks out of the flower bed. And I was bringing too much attention to the police, to the house. I had got stabbed, I got robbed, I got beat down. I swallowed five $20 rocks with Compton PD, tried to choke them out of me. And it had not been for some Epicat, the stuff to make you throw up, that my ex-old lady just happened to have in the medicine cabinet when I got here. I mean, you know, when I got to her house, and that was God. I know it's God. See, I didn't believe in God. I believed in money. But after being around here and examining my relationship with this power, man, I just started to see and looking at my truth about all the stuff that had happened to me. I know that there had to be nothing but a God. And my God in the beginning was called Lucky. Every time I thought I was lucky, that was God. So my God's nickname is Lucky. But anyway, let me get back to before November 8th, 1988. I'm 6'4". I'm weighing 150 pounds. Today, I'm 6'4", and I weigh 275 pounds. So you can just imagine what I look like. I'm jaundiced. I hadn't shit-shaved a baby in 19 days. I had caught a possession beef at this place called Wilmington Arms, coming out of there. Here it is November the 8th. I'm back in the Wilmington Arms. I've been up for days. I'm hallucinating. I'm hearing voices. I'm seeing things. And this is always common for me to see. I'm losing days. I'm losing time. I'm losing my dope. I'm losing my money. I'm hiding stuff from my own self and can't find it. So if you can relate, you can relate. You know, and they say how dark it is before the dawn. And I'm a firm believer the 12 steps work real good, real, real good. But what works better is a black eye and a swollen lip. They told me the worse off you are when you get here, the better off your chances of staying. They said most of us, of my variety, have to become badly mangled in order to get this. And they say we have to be desperate in order to get this. Not only desperate, but desperate enough to know we need to do in order to stay here. You know, and what happened for me, man, step one, to hear people talk about that we admit that we're addict and alcoholic and we accept that we're addict and alcoholic. Well, I had done that long before I came to the rooms of Cocaine Anonymous. You know, I had admitted to anybody who would listen to me, they would give me a $20 rock and give me some credit. Hey, yeah, man, I'm an addict. Yeah, I'm a crackhead. Yeah, man, you know I'm sick. And I accepted the fact, too. I accepted the fact that I was a dope fiend. I was going to die that way. I didn't see any way out. I just didn't want to die from an underdose. So what happened was, man, on November 8, 1988, I come out of the Wilmington Arms once again. I'm seeing shadows. I'm hearing voices. I'm seeing people. It sounded like somebody said, come here, Starving Marvin. And I thought it was Compton PD again. I run, I fall, I slip, and I bust up my leg. Now, I got a Volkswagen, a 69 Volkswagen, was sitting in the dope spot for 6 months, and all I needed was about $40 worth of work, and I couldn't get it fixed. And I'm unemployed. And Norma had put a restraining order on me, my greatest enabler. And Norma tried to introduce me to this program. Norma said, Doc Ellis, who's in the big meeting in the sky, who's one of my best friends in the program, who's in the meeting in the sky, along with Daryl Williams out of Houston, Texas, and Robert Glover, and a host of other people that aided and helped me in my recovery. Said, Doc, to sit beside the bed. When I wake up, he's sitting on the side of the bed trying to 12-step. Norma would bring people from there. It's the solution meeting from Compton, California, and the natural high meeting from 3001 Southwestern. And she would invite people to come over for barbecues and fish fries and try to introduce me to this program. Norma had bought Joe and Charlie Big Book Come Alive cassettes. That's how long ago this was. And was playing the cassettes in the car while she's taking me to and from the dope spot. Norma loved me and almost loved me to death. Norma could not say no. But Norma finally got in contact with Alana. And Norma finally got in contact with the Tough Sisters over in Compton. And they told him, you're going to have to let them go, Norma. And so what happened one time, man, Norma wouldn't let me have my way. I hit Norma. She called the police, put a restraining order on me, and I can't go back to Carson, California. 4-bedroom, 2-car garage, picket fence, fireplace, beautiful, beautiful house. I got a beautiful 4x4 Toyota 4Runner that Norma is in her name on her credit union. And Norma used to take my dope. And she's a postal worker. And postal workers are federal workers. And Norma would take 0.5 ounces of dope and 8 bottles of dope to work with her and lock it up in her locker and put it in the trunk of her car. Can you imagine the time she would have got if she got busted with that dope on a federal installation? Norma tried to introduce me to this program and you people and this way of living, but I was defiant. I wasn't in denial. I was just defiant about doing anything about my condition. But on November the 8th, man, the rubber met the road. I'm coming out of there. I slipped. I fell. I've been up for 19, 21 days. There's a lot of remorse. And there's a lot of guilt because my daughter's birthday was coming soon. My wife's birthday was November. My wife took it. And it took me a while before I even realized I got sober on my wife's birthday, which is November the 8th. My daughter's birthday was November the 3rd. People from the job that was relying on me would come by looking for me in the neighborhood. My homeboys was trying to help me. You know, Norma had closed that door. The stepsons had closed the door. How dark it is before the dawn. They say most of us have to become badly mangled. And that's what happened for me on November the 8th. The guy that took me over to the place saw me fall. He drove the car up in front of the place, picked me up, threw me in the car. We go back to the spot. We're sitting in the car and we smoking. Now, I had come up, and I hadn't had this much money in a while. I came up with $600 because I robbed somebody. And I had $600, so I bought a 0.5 ounce of dope, a brand new lighter, brand new pipe. And I'm sitting there getting loaded with this guy, and I start to cry. I tell him, man, get the F out of here. And he left. I gave him a piece of dope. And I'm sitting there, and I'm smoking. And it just wasn't working. It had stopped working. The physical pain, the emotional pain, that was all seemed like everything just came down on me. It was like the floodgates had opened up. And I just seen my life. I seen my wife. I seen my kids. I seen the job. I seen the condition that I was in. I was able to see, had a moment of clarity that, you know, that the jig was up. So I go to the door and I knock on the door. I say, Jerry, can I use the phone? He said, get the F away from here. My mama's tired of you. We tired of you. Man, you bringing heat to the house. Get your car out the driveway. And I did something I've never done before in my entire life. I said, God, please help me. And he did. He said, you tell Jerry you gave me a lighter, your pipe, your money, and your dope if he lets you use the phone. And the door blew open. I go in, I call Norma, and I pass out. I tell Norma I'm hurt, I'm sick, and I need help. Now, Norma is the one who put the restraining order on. Norma didn't want to have anything to do with it, but God touched her heart. She picks me up. She takes me to the hospital. 18 hours later, I come out of the hospital on crutches. Norma's 4'8", little Mexican girl I've been with for 6 years. Norma got strong that night. Norma threw up an arm block and said, Marvin, what you going to do? She said, you can't work, you can't gamble, you can't hustle, and you can't come back to my house. She said, why don't you try recovery? And I said something I never said before in my life. I said, okay. She puts me in the car. She takes me to North Long Beach to a girl named Shay Shay, whose name was Sharon T, who worked at the Solution Drop-In Center in the daytime that did referrals to detox. Sharon wasn't home, but Derek was there. Said, man, Sharon's gone. We don't know when she's going to be back. So I said, ooh, I'm in the backseat of the car. I know she's going to take me home, shoot me in the ass with some B12 shots, let me eat some noodles, sleep for 3 days, give me $20, and let me go back to what I do best. But it didn't work out like that. So as we come out on Bourne Street and Long Beach Boulevard, run dead in the shade. Norma made a U-turn, stayed in the house, seemed like it was for hours. They finally got a place. They took me to El Monte Detox, and my recovery began on November 8th, 1988. And in El Monte Detox for 7 days, that's where I started to learn what I truly suffer from. And God revealed to me that, you know, you're truly going to need to get some help. So I left there, I went to Ron Pounds Recovery Home, and I stayed there for 90 days, and I came in contact with people just like me. It was a men and women, 250 men and women,
in a hotel that used to be owned by Jack Dempsey, not far from downtown Los Angeles. And they were so lax. If you wanted to get loaded, you could get loaded. Because they're getting loaded on the rooftop. It's getting loaded in the alley out back. There's a motel right across the street where there was flickering lighters all day and all night. I was on the second floor, and I could look out my window, and I could see the flickering of the lights. There's a park called Lafayette Park, and there's called MacArthur Park. It was right within walking distance. And if I wanted to get loaded, I could have went to the park. But something happened for me. While I was in that recovery home program, I seen the disease of alcohol and drug addiction. They told me, if you spot it, you got it. And God was able to allow me to listen, so I could learn to listen. Something happened. Around 45 days, we had an earthquake. And they was going to kick me out of the program. And that's too long of a story to even go into. And they're going to kick me out of that program. And they're going to make that decision that night. And the earthquake was like 6 a.m. in the morning. I'm smoking cigarettes. I'm sitting on the side of my bed, looking out the windows, tearing up. Like, I don't know, man, what am I going to do? Why did I do and say what I did? Because they're going to put me out of here. And people were screaming and howling because the building, it's a four-story hotel, a four-story building. And it was swaying back and forth. The people were running out the house. I look out the window, and I can see people half naked, and women running out the house screaming and hollering. And a voice came to me. It said, it's going to be all right. I calmly walked out. That afternoon, they told me I could stay, but I was going to be on restriction. And after that, I joined a book study down in the bottom of the basement. And that's why I had my first step experience. And what happened for me was I was able to learn what it truly means to be an alcoholic. I got a full knowledge of my condition. I realized I used to be a cucumber, but now I'm a pickle. And I can never become a cucumber again. And that lack of power was my dilemma. And I found out that, you know, I'm gonna share with you a simple approach to the 12 steps. Step one, there's a power that's trying to kill me. Step two, there's a power that wants me to live. Step three, which do you want? If you want to die, stop here. If you want to live, go on. Step four, using examples from your own life, understand that selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear control your actions. Step five, tell all your private embarrassing secrets to another person. Step six, decide whether or not you want to live that way anymore. Step seven, if you want your life to change, ask the power greater than yourself to change it for you. Because if you could have changed it, you'd have done it a long time ago. Steps eight, figure out how to make right all the things you did wrong. Steps nine, fix what you can without causing any more trouble in the process. Step 10, understand that making mistakes is part of being human. When you make a mistake, fix it immediately if you can. Step 11, ask for help to treat yourself and others the way you want your higher power to treat you. And step 12, don't stop doing 1 through 11 and pass it on. And that's what I had learned early on. I was given this, and I got with a group of people who was advocating the solution. And I got in a workshop downstairs in the basement. We went through the first three steps. And they told me I had to draw a conclusion in step one. They told me I had to draw a conclusion in step two. That first of all, step one is that the problem is that I'm powerless. And then step two, that I don't have the needed power, but there is a power. And step three, that I would have to make a decision to turn my will and my life, which is my thoughts and my actions, over to that power. So I was able to do the third step prayer with this group. I was able to start doing inventory. And by now, 89 days had rolled around, and I had to leave the program. And I knocked around the program for a good probably 6-9 months. No, a good 6 months after leaving the program without getting a sponsor. And then all of a sudden, I got the bright idea that I could sell dope in recovery. And I was on my way to a panel, and I stopped off to get a pack of cigarettes. And I ran to a guy, asked me for $1 for a bottle of wine. Now, by now, I could recite a whole lot of stuff from the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a whole gang of information. I've been to a whole gang of meetings. I had already became of service. I was in hospitals and institutions because I joined H&I, was 96 days clean and sober. I had gone to a convention already, had gone to marathons, I had gone to picnics, I had gone to dances, I had gone to Joe and Charlie Big Book Comes Alive workshop. I had gone to another workshop to Carl Erbach, who is currently my sponsor today, who did a four-step workshop where he takes you through the workshop, all four steps in 3 days. I had written some inventory, and I had a whole lot of knowledge. And I could quote a whole lot of things. I could quote, rarely have we seen a person fall 35 on path. Those who not recovered people cannot, will not be able to get themselves this simple program. Usually men and women constant, I have a vision for you. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize only a little. God will constantly disclose the promises. We painstaking about this phase of development we made before you halfway through. You're going to comprehend it with serenity, you know, peace. No matter, I had knew all that. I knew some page numbers, you know. I knew what was on page 99 to 12. What's on the page 52? I know the old to be double events. You know what, the 449. Well, now they talk about 417. What's on 569? Spiritual experience versus spiritual awakening. I knew all this stuff. And I was quoting a whole lot of good shit from Napoleon. And they told me self-knowledge alone will not keep you sober. And man, I was getting ready to buy me some dope. And I started getting irritable and restless and discontent in sobriety. It started to become very boring. And the streets are starting to, like I told you, I'm addicted to excitement, drama, and bullshit. And I'm starting to go back and back more and more back to the old neighborhood again. I'm starting to hang out. I'm starting lying on the job. I'm starting stealing. You know, I got two women in the program now at the same time, you know. And so what happened was I'm going to a meeting down on Skid Row, and I stopped to get a pack of cigarettes, and a guy asked me for $1 for a bottle of wine. And I said, man, I can't give you no money, man. I'm a member of CA and AA. He said, that shit don't work. I said, what you mean it don't work? He said, really, have we seen a person pass 35 or past? Those are not recovered. I said, oh, shit. I gave him $1. I said, can you do the promise? He said, if you pay sick about this phase of development, you'll be made quite free too. I gave him $1. I said, can you do a vision for you? He said, a book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only live, but God will constantly disclose. I said, oh, shit. So when I got to the meeting, it just so happened, Dr. George is at the same meeting, a guy I've been watching from Compton for years. And he was doing a workshop. I was starting a workshop at his house. And I ran up to him. I said, hey, George, I hear you doing a workshop. He said, yeah. I said, man, will you sponsor me, man? He said, yeah, under one condition, you get in the workshop. And that's what I did, man. I got in a workshop with Dr. George. I got a whole lot of information. I did some work. But I'm going to be honest with you guys, because I'm running out of time. I was around here for 12 years. I never sponsored anybody. But I was the chair of South Central District. I'm the founder of hospitals and institutions. South Central District was the chair for 5 years when the area shut it down. The area here in Los Angeles that shut down H&I when they stopped bringing the message to Skid Row and to South Central. And I called for an emergency meeting because I was a member of H&I in Long Beach Compton District. We called for an emergency meeting. Ina, me, Craig, and a bunch of us, we founded South Central District H&I. And I was a chair for 5 years because I didn't want my baby to get destroyed. I've been a hotel liaison. I've been a marathon chair. I've done four-step workshops with Paul Erberg. I facilitated a love and service inventories. I mean, love and service workshops. I've done group inventories and facilitated with Leon Strings. I've been to Joe and Charlie work. I sponsored 9 guys and went to Joe and Charlie Big Book Comes Alive workshop again. I did a whole lot of service for 12 years and I never sponsored anybody. They said there'll come a time they won't have no effective mental defense. And they told me that I'm going to become irritable, restless, and discontent. And it showed up for me, man. At 12 years clean and sober, I was going to kill another member of Cocaine Anonymous. And I'm not going to go into all the stuff that I had purchased and all the planning I had done. And but for the grace of God who intervened and put Carl Erbach in my life. And I already did a four-step workshop with him, but he had started a workshop where it takes people through the work in 8 weeks. And out of desperation, out of killing myself or killing somebody or going to penitentiary for the rest of my life, I joined that workshop. And I was willing to seek counsel, take direction. I didn't talk back because I was a drowning man. And a drowning man, when you're drowning, you don't talk back. And I did everything he told me to do for those 8 weeks. And I come out on the other side, I started sponsoring. And my first sponsor Fonseca was Neil. He's a guy who could hardly read and write. And he died just at the beginning of this COVID. Just at the beginning of COVID, Neil died. They finally did his trade. And it broke my heart. And I always thank Neil. And I always thank the other guys that's been with me now that I sponsored for allowing me to help them help me. I don't take them through the work. We go through the work together because I got a seventh grade education. I got a guy who went to school with O.J. Simpson. I got a doctor who's a brain surgeon that calls me sponsored. I got guys who are far more intelligent than I am. I got guys with 25 years that's sober. You know, God has blessed me, man. God has truly blessed me. I've had two heart attacks, open heart surgery, and two stents. I was in Amsterdam speaking. I almost didn't make it back just before the pandemic because I had to go back in the hospital and be rushed to put another stent in my heart. I'm living two lifestyles in one lifetime on borrowed time. I've never had a bad day in recovery. I've had some bad moments. I didn't go home. I left St. Joseph, Missouri in 1970. I don't go back home until 1992 because of behind the resentment. I hated my father. I didn't like my mother. I didn't like the state of Missouri or the police department because they killed my partner. And my mother died when I had 3 years clean and sober on Thanksgiving night. And I went home and my father and I, he said, "You hate me, don't you?" And I started crying. And I love my father. For the day he died, he called me baby boy. He wouldn't let nobody touch me. He had cancer. And I'd go home every Thanksgiving to be with my father. And I'd go home every chance I could be to be with my father. I've grown closer to my brothers. I was a total stranger. All they heard was about me, but they didn't know me. I've grown closer to my sister. My mother died. My father died. My sponsor died. My first sponsor, Dr. George, got loaded after 12 years clean and sober. One of my sponsors, Brother Harold, died. Robert G. died. One of my best friends, Daryl Williams. Some of you guys, somebody might know Daryl from Houston, Texas. My best friend, he died, man. My wife is going to be speaking next month in Houston. I'm not going because I just can't go. I can't go. Not right now. I'm still processing his death, you know. So acceptance is not the key. There's a lot of things that I just don't accept. I don't accept since right here in America. I don't accept systemic racism. I don't accept sex trafficking. You know, I don't accept these police killings that's going on in America. And I'm living with it. So, you know, I met Dr. Paulo, the addict alcoholic, in San Diego at the World Service Convention, along with his wife, Max. That's Paulo's story. That's not my story. And I'm no parent. I find my own truth here. I pray and I ask God to please give me the grace to completely give myself to this program. God gave me the grace to make the mission to my animal self. I'm an addict, I'm an alcoholic. I wake up every morning. I read the quiet piece that's sitting right beside me right now. I read the 24-hour day book that was given to me in 1989 by Norma's daughter. And I read the 12 and 12 on page 99 in the 12 and 12. I love the 11-step prayer. Okay? Now I'm gonna end this, but I'm gonna tell you how I know that I've had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. One, an increased tendency to let things happen rather than make them happen. Two, frequent attacks of smiling. Three, feeling of being connected with others and nature. Four, frequent overwhelming episodes of appreciation. Five, a tendency to think and act spontaneously rather than fear-based or past experiences. Six, an unmistakable ability to enjoy each moment. Seven, a loss of ability to worry. Eight, a loss of interest in conflict. Nine, a loss of interest in interpreting the actions of others. 10, a loss of interest in judging others. 11, a loss of interest in judging self. And 12, gaining the ability to love without expecting anything in return. Thank you for listening.